This week on Behind the Bars, we explore the life and crimes of Ed Gein. Ed Gein, also known as the Plainfield Ghoul, was a necrophiliac killer and suspected serial killer during the 1950s. He was inspiration behind such films as Texas Chainsaw Massacre, House of a Thousand Corpses, and The Devil's Rejects. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Behind the Bars podcast. I am McKenna, and This is DB.
Hello, hello.
And today, despite some confusion, we are covering Ed Gein, also known as the Plainfield Butcher, or the Mad Butcher, or the Plainfield Ghoul, or as I call him, the Plainfield Arts and Craftser.
So I apologize in advance for the kind of chaos you're going to listen to, because I researched a different killer because I don't know my own podcast. I thought we were doing Albert Fish.
Super excited about Albert Fish. We like got on and he was like, did you looked up him? Are you ready? And started like rattling off a bunch of stuff. And I was like, none of this sounds right. Hold on. And we had to actually listen back to last week's podcast to see who we were actually doing.
So I fucked up, and so we're going to wing this. Thankfully, I know enough about him that we'll be all right. So, like you said,
plenty of research, so we're good to go, y'all.
We have Edward Theodore Gein. Like she said, she is known as the Mad Butcher, Plainfield Ghoul, Butcher Plainfield. So pretty much any variation of that. This guy's actually kind of close to me. I've actually been to his grave, which is pretty cool if you get the chance. He was born August 29th, 1906. He was born in La Crosse County, Wisconsin. He died on July 26th, 1984. And if I remember right, he died in prison. I can't remember what he died from offhand because...
Respiratory and heart failure due to lung cancer.
Liver cancer.
Lung cancer?
Liver cancer? Okay, I have liver cancer and I have lung cancer listed here. So he died from cancer.
He died from a kind of cancer.
Yeah, I mean, fitting. He died in Madison, Wisconsin. Like I said, died in prison. Occupation, numerous jobs. He was a master of arts and crafts, particularly belts.
And lampshades.
Yeah. This is the guy they based Texas Chainsaw Massacre off of, so that kind of gives you a foreshadowing to how evil he was. He was a necrophiliac. They have him listed as a serial killer because he has anywhere from 2 to 9 victims, with it being only 2 confirmed. He's not really a serial killer. His
He's MO... also not really a necrophiliac. There's a definite quote of him saying that he didn't have sex with the bodies because they smell bad. So, yeah. Like, he had an infatuation, I guess he could say he had an infatuation with the dead because of what we'll talk about, but, like, he didn't have intercourse with the dead, which is, like, my interpretation of necrophilia.
Yeah. So, his MO, or, you know, his calling card, shooting, once again, pretty boring, and post-mortem mutilation, aka arts and crafts.
Arts and crafts.
Yeah, they claim he was very disorganized, which, I mean, when you have that many art projects going on at once, it gets messy.
He was an artist.
Yeah. It was
his process.
Number of victims, like we said, 2 to 9. Span of crimes was from 19... Well, there's 2 different ones. His confirmed one was December 8th, 1954 to November 17th, 1957. So roughly 3-year span. And the other possible one was May 16th, 1944 to November 17th, 1954.
Yep.
So 10 years. Conveniently, they ran together. So that's, they don't know how many people he actually killed, but it was on a creepy farm nonetheless, which is kind of weird. I've been to where it was at. So it's weird. Sentence, institutionalization, because they found him not guilty due to insanity. Apprehended November of 1957, and like we said, he died in prison from some form of cancer. Liver cancer, lung cancer, what else did they have on here? Respiratory and heart failure. So,
yeah,
he just died. he needed to.
Yeah.
So I am going to have McKenna start and tell us about his childhood.
Okay. Well, as with any serial killer, his childhood was odd. Wasn't necessarily bad. It was odd. But as is consistent with Ed Kemper from last week, we had some mommy issues. Ed Gein's, I think, honestly might have been a different but worse. So like you said, Gein was born in La Crosse County, Wisconsin on August 27th, 1906, the second of two boys. His mother was named Augusta, and Augusta hated her husband, which also a theme. He was an alcoholic, unable to keep a job. He was a carpenter, a tanner, owned a grocery store for a little bit, sold the business. The family left to live in isolation on a 155-acre farm in the town of Plainfield, Wisconsin, which became the Gein family permanent residence. Augusta really embraced the isolation, turned away outsiders that could have poorly influenced her sons. She was a very religious woman. And one article that I read said that Gein had this almost Oedipal relationship with his mother. Oedipal being in reference to Oedipus, who, if you aren't familiar with the Greek mythology, was the man who was prophesied to fuck his mother and kill his father, which, despite his father's attempts to keep this from happening, still wound up happening. So Oedipal, meaning Gein loved his mother bizarrely, so was bizarrely in love with his mother.
So outside of school, Gein really didn't do much besides doing chores on the farm. His mother was, like McKenna said, religious to a point that was just, it was overkill. She commonly preached to all of her sons about the innate morality of the world, the evil of drinking, and that her belief that all women besides herself were naturally promiscuous and instruments of the devil. She spent time every afternoon reading them from the Bible, usually selecting books from the Old Testament, and most of them were about death, murder, and divine retribution. No wonder he turned out to be a murderer. He was very, very shy, and they remember his classmates and teachers always remember he had really strange mannerisms. He laughed at weird times. He was very, very, he was a social outcast. And whenever he tried to make friends, his mom would actually punish him because he didn't need friends. He just needed to come work on the farm and be with her. And that was it. Even though he had poor social skills, he did fairly well in school, particularly in reading, which a lot of killers actually did very poorly in school.
Yeah.
So it was odd that he stood out a little bit.
Just again, a lot of like parallels between him and Kemper, which is funny that we like, they commonly get confused, and we kept bringing Gein up last week when we covered Kemper, like both super intelligent, both with weird mommy issues.
Yeah. Thankfully I don't have mommy issues.
Guys, DB keeps making references about the fact that, like, he's a killer, and I keep laughing them off. And, like, if I turn up dead, y'all, it's him.
Oh, gee, thanks. I am innocent. I'm not that great at arts and crafts, so it wasn't me.
So if there's really shitty arts and crafts done with my body, you know why. On October 1st, 1940, Ed Gein's father, George, died of heart failure due to his alcoholism at the age of 66. And so Ed and his brother, Henry, began doing odd jobs around town to cover their living expenses. They were considered reliable and honest by the residents of their community. Ed frequently babysat for his neighbors and I guess really was known for getting along remarkably well with children.
Henry, sure he did.
I don't think he did anything wrong. I don't get that impression from him at this age. I think he just...
Oh, sorry. I was thinking wrong killer.
Get it together. Not fish. We're doing fish next week, everybody. Get
sure prepared. We are.
DB has had so many weeks to prepare. But he really got along well with kids. His brother Henry began... dating a divorced mother of two and kind of moved in with her and was honestly really concerned about Ed's attachment with their mother. And he often spoke ill of her around Ed. And Ed was shocked and hurt by this. Again, he had this really odd attachment with his mom. Henry, I think, was kind of onto the fact that mom was weird. And Ed didn't appreciate that. So on May 16th, 1944, Henry and Ed were burning away marsh vegetation on the property. The fire got out of control, which drew attention from the local fire department. At the end of the day, Ed reported his brother missing. And so everybody went searching. The police came in, but then Ed led the police directly to his brother's body. Cause of death was deemed heart failure, but he had no burns on his body. He had not been injured otherwise, or so they thought, until later investigation found a blunt force injury to his head, but they didn't further investigate it. So this is not one of the murders that Ed Gein is attributed with. They
yes
don't
know. So
right. Like they don't, there's no like hard evidence. He was never tried for killing his brother, but no. Like he definitely killed his brother.
The county coroner actually officially labeled the cause of death asphyxiation. So, yeah,
but,
he had bruises
like,
on his head.
Maybe smoke, but not.
Yeah, he killed his brother.
Mm-hmm.
So after his brother either got murdered, died, whichever story you want to believe, it was just now him and his mother on the farm. At this time, Augusta had a paralyzing stroke right after the death, and Gein devoted himself to taking care of her. Sometime in 1945... Ignore that. Sorry. I was reading the wrong part. Of course. I'm a mess today. So, okay.
You're spot on. No, sometime in 1945, his mother visited a man named Smith who lived nearby.
Yes.
Is that what you're going for? Yeah.
Yep. It was to purchase some straw. According to Gein, his mother witnessed Smith beating a dog, and a woman inside the Smith home came out and yelled for him to stop. But Smith beat the dog to death. Augusta was extremely upset, but it didn't really appear that she was bothered by it overall. She was more upset that he did this in the presence of a woman, not that he beat the dog to death. So it was a little weird. She told Gein that the woman was not married to Smith, so she had no business being there anyway, and that she was Smith's harlot. So she wasn't mad that this guy just beat this dog to death. It's, well, he did it by a woman who's a harlot, though, so it shouldn't matter.
Ugh.
Yeah. So shortly after this, she actually had a second stroke, and her health deteriorated rapidly, which she kind of deserves. On December 29th of 1945, at the age of 67, she died. Like we said, he had a lot of mommy issues, so obviously he was devastated by her death. And an author was actually quoted saying he had lost his only friend and one true love, and he was absolutely alone in the world. So he's
which is like so sad, but doesn't in any way justify the the nastiness that he goes on to do.
Yeah. So
go ahead.
After this, Gene actually managed to hold on to the farm and earn money from odd jobs. This is where it gets a little weird. He actually boarded up all the rooms that were used by his mother, including the upstairs, the downstairs parlor, and the living room, leaving them untouched from when she died. He never really went in there again. So he had this really small house at this point. He had a small room next to the kitchen and the kitchen himself. That's it. But they claim it was pristine. He started collecting different magazines, adventure stories, and a lot of these actually involve cannibals and Nazi atrocities. Once again, kind of some foreshadowing to what's to come. He was a handyman and received different subsidies from the federal government, and this started in 1951. Occasionally, he worked for a municipal road crew and crop threshing crews in the area. And sometime between 46 and 56, he sold an 80-acre parcel of land that his brother Henry had owned. He'd taken it in, didn't need it anymore, sold it off.
And then on the morning of November 16th, 1957, everything goes a little crazy.
Yeah.
Plainfield hardware store owner Bernice Warden disappears. A resident reported that the hardware store's truck had been driven out from the rear of the building around 9:30 that morning. The hardware store saw a couple people that day. And then Bernice Warden's son, Deputy Sheriff Frank Warden, entered the store around 5 o'clock. The cash register was open and there was blood on the floor. And Frank Warden told investigators that Gene had been in the store the evening before his mother's disappearance, saying that he would come back later the next morning for a gallon of antifreeze. A sales slip confirms that antifreeze was the last thing that Warden had sold. And on the evening of that same day, Gene was arrested at the West Plainfield grocery store. A county sheriff deputy discovered Warden's decapitated body in a shed on Gene's property, and she was hung upside down and dressed out like a deer. So she had a crossbar at her ankles, ropes at her wrists, and then the deer, the way that people dress deer with like the slit down the middle and ripping the skin off. She'd been shot with a .22 caliber rifle, and all the mutilations were made after her death. So unlike Robert Berdella, he kills people and then tears them apart.
Yes. So Solid. After they found this, obviously they're going to search the house. So here is a giant list. I'm going to try to run through this pretty quick, but it's important. So they found whole human bones and human fragments. They found a waste paper basket made of human skins covering several chair seats, skulls on his bedpost, female skulls, some of which with the top cap was sawn off. Bowls made from human skulls. I mean, who doesn't have that? A corset made from a female torso, skin from shoulders to waist. Leggings made of some human leg skin. Talk about a tight fit.
I bet those are so comfy, though.
Right. Masks made from the skin of female heads, hence Texas Chainsaw Massacre. That's what they wore. Mary Hogan's face mask in a paper bag. Mary Hogan's skull in a box. Bernice Warden's entire head in a burlap sack, Bernice Warden's heart in a plastic bag in the front of Gene's potbelly stove, 9 vulvae in a shoebox, a young girl's dress and 2 vulvas of 2 females judged to be about 15 years old. My personal favorite, a belt made from female human nipples. I've seen pictures. It's a horribly made belt, but you know, it is what it is. 4 noses, a pair of lips that were actually on the drawstring of a window shade, a lampshade made from skin of a human face, and fingernails from female fingers. So I know that was a long list, but this kind of shows you how fucked up this guy was.
It shows you how crafty he was.
How crafty.
He was so crafty, his medium just happened to be the dead human body.
You know, we all have our things.
This man was so crafty.
Was he just a misunderstood artist?
I mean, maybe. Because here's the thing. In reality, how many people do we know he killed? Two.
But he had body parts of...
He maybe killed more. 4 to 9. 2 to 9, but 4 to 9. But he just got all of his body parts out of the cemetery.
Yeah.
Like, it was just his medium as an artiste. I think he was misunderstood.
Right. Anyway. So all these artifacts were photographed at State Crime Lab, and they, quote unquote, were decently disposed of.
They were cremated.
Yeah.
Whatever.
Which I know there are some artifacts. Yeah, there are some artifacts of his still out there.
There
like
are.
Crime museums and stuff, but like the belt's gone, stuff like that. So
sad, because like I don't know. I would pay money to go see them, and I would just hope that money would go to like a survivor fund, you know, like, let me go see Ed Gein's art and I will give money to something else.
Do I need to make you a belt?
Out of human nipples?
Well, I never said that.
Go for it.
Let me just track down nipples. You know, I think I'm out of them right
just
now.
Do what Gein did. You just go to a cemetery. You look up obituaries. When the graves are fresh, you go and you dig up the ladies and you cut their nipples off.
Yeah, because that's how I want to spend my nights. You know, I'm sorry, I'm fresh out of nipples. How about noses?
He and a guy named Gus is apparently how they spent their nights.
Well, tell us about them.
Gein told investigators that between 1947 and 1952, he made as many as 40 nocturnal visits to 3 local graveyards to exhume recently buried bodies while he was in, quote, a daze-like state. On about 30 of these visits, he said he came out of the daze while in the cemetery, left the grave in good order, returned home empty-handed. On other occasions, he dug up the graves of recently buried middle-aged women he thought represented his mother or resembled his mother, and took the bodies home where he tanned their skins to make his paraphernalia. I've only found a couple of references to another gentleman that apparently he went and dug bodies up with, a man named Gus. And it was only after Gus was admitted to like an old person's home that Gein began killing. And it was those last two murders where he was caught and convicted, because Gus was no longer with him to dig up bodies. But Gein admitted to stealing from 9 graves from local cemeteries, led investigators to the exact locations. The caskets were inside wooden boxes. The top boards ran crossways, not lengthways. The top of the boxes were about 2 feet below the surfaces in sandy soil, which made sense because Gein was kind of a slight guy. So yeah, it's not like he's going to be digging 6 feet of soil to get to like a big bulky casket. These were fresh graves under 2 feet of sand, pretty much, and really like easy caskets. They robbed the graves soon after the funerals while the graves were not completed, hence why they were so close to the surface. The test graves were exhumed because authorities were uncertain as to whether the slight Gein was capable of single-handedly digging up a grave during a single evening, but they were exactly as he described them. 2 of the exhumed graves were found empty. 1 had a crowbar in place of a body. I don't know why he left a crowbar there.
Yeah, you know, you think you would need that for the next one.
For the next one, right?
Which is convenient because he couldn't open one of the next ones because he lost his pry bar.
He lost the crowbar. It's, oh shit. I buried it with Mary. One casket was empty. 1 casket Gein had failed to open when he lost his pry bar. I don't think he lost it. He left it in the other grave. Yeah.
And then the last one that kills me. Most of the body was gone from the 3rd grave. What do you mean most of what constitutes as most of a body?
I mean, he probably took her head because, like, as we know later, like, people saw that he had shrunken heads in his house. And they were like, oh, he just has Mentos from other weird places.
Yeah.
No, 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 no. No, that's Nancy from down the street who died 3 weeks ago.
Yet he returned some of the jewelry and some body parts, though. So, I mean, hey, you know, he tried to be considerate.
Considerate. Arts and crafts, not stealing. Difference.
Speaking of arts and crafts, so shortly after his mother's death, Gein actually began to create a woman's suit so he could become his mother and literally crawl into her skin.
That's healthy.
Talk about creepy. You know, mommy issues, nah, that takes a little too literally. So Gein, once, you know, McKenna said this earlier, he actually denied having sex with the bodies he exhumed, explaining they smelled too bad. I don't really buy it.
You don't?
No.
I totally buy it.
Out of the shit he did, I think he wore dead people's faces. So I don't think smelling bad's a...
But they were tanned at that point. Like, taxidermy doesn't smell. Once you tan skin, it doesn't really smell. And I think...
Is that what I'm doing wrong with mine?
Yes.
Damn it. I'm going to get raided by the cops or something one day. They're going to be looking for these dead people.
We're both going to have cops at our doors. Jesus.
They're going to find me sitting here with my fat cat. And they're like, have fun. Look around.
His mother put the fear of God in him about having sex with women. I don't think he could have, even if he wanted to, because his mother's voice would have been in his head. I really think this was all mommy arts and crafts. I really don't think he did anything sexual with these bodies. I don't. I don't think he would have been able to.
I don't know. I'm iffy. Anyway, after this, during the interrogation, he actually admitted to the shooting death of Mary Hogan, who was the tavern owner, who had been missing since 1954, and they actually found her head in his house. But later he claimed he had no memory of the details of her death, which, once again, I don't really believe.
Yeah. And then, like I said, there was a 16-year-old whose parents were friends of Gein, attended ball games and movies with him, and reported that Gein kept shrunken heads in his house. And Gein had always said they were relics from the Philippines, sent by a cousin who had served during World War II. But, of course, upon investigation, the police determined that they were human facial skins peeled from corpses in the cemetery that Gein had used as masks. So, like, honestly, pretty talented. Like, making shrunken heads is hard. So, like, kudos, sir, that you were able to do that.
Yeah.
I guess, kind of.
So,
and Gein was considered a suspect in several other cases in Wisconsin, including the 1953 disappearance of Evelyn Hartley, who was a lacrosse babysitter. But obviously never convicted of that one.
Yes.
And during questioning this, this is where this whole thing gets kind of weird. During questioning, the county sheriff, Art Schley, reportedly assaulted Gein by banging his head and face into a brick wall. And so the initial confession was ruled inadmissible. Obviously, if you beat somebody, that confession doesn't make
it. Yeah. Not saying he didn't deserve it, but...
No, not saying that at all, but just saying that anything that came after getting his face beat into a brick wall doesn't count.
Yeah. Unfortunately, Sheely actually died at the age of 43 from heart failure. So this was actually before Gein's trial. So they really couldn't use anything he'd done. Many of those people who knew Sheely said that he was traumatized by the horror of Gein's crime. And he was scared to testify against Gein. And one of his friends actually said that he was a victim of Ed Gein as surely as if he had been butchered by him. I mean, a case of this magnitude, that's not something most people are going to ever see. So the fact that it was a small town sheriff that ended up having to deal with this is a big thing.
Oh, absolutely. And I feel like Sheely was one of the ones that went into the house and saw everything.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he was scarred from that, scarred from his interactions with Gein. You can't blame the guy for being completely overwhelmed.
Yeah.
So on November 21st, 1957, Gein was arraigned on one count of first-degree murder, where he pleaded not guilty by reason of insanity. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia, found mentally incompetent and thus unfit for trial.
I don't think he was really mentally incompetent. I mean, they said he did well in school. Clearly he could provide for himself. I think he played the insanity card very well. He knew what to do so he wouldn't go to prison.
Absolutely. I don't know. It's unlike Ed Kemper, where we have that information of the feelings of remorse or anything like that. Like, I couldn't find anything like that with Gene, of him feeling like, I know what I did was wrong. Nothing like that is there. So it's hard to say whether or not his claims of feeling like he was in a blur when he was digging up these bodies is valid. I kind of agree with you. I don't think it is. But regardless, he was declared unfit for trial, sent to the Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, which is now the Dodge Correctional Institution in Waupun, Wisconsin, and then later transferred to the Mendota State Hospital in Madison, Wisconsin.
And that's where he actually died.
It is. In 1968, they determined that Gene was mentally able to confer with counsel and participate in his defense. And so trials began November 7th, 1968. They lasted a week.
I'm a little shocked that even lasted a week, because, I mean, he had pretty good evidence against him.
He did. And so, yeah, I'm wondering what took so long. A psychiatrist testified that Gene had told him that he didn't know whether the killing of Bernice Worden was intentional or accidental. Gene told him that while he examined a gun in Worden's store, the gun went off, killing Worden. Gene testified that after trying to load a bullet into the rifle, it discharged. He said he had not aimed the rifle at Worden and did not remember anything else that happened that morning. Here's the problem with that. You're looking at a gun, the gun goes off. The gun killed her. Then you took her home, hung her up by her ankles, and dressed her like a deer.
Well, he needed it. The body was going to go to waste if he didn't.
I know.
He needed those nipples.
Supplies for his arts and crafts. I get that. But we can't use an insanity defense for that. No. Insanity works for, I was loading a gun, gun went off, lady dead. Yeah. Honestly, that works for like Republican incompetence. But beyond that, once she was dead and you took her home and dressed her like a deer, that's where I need you to have a little bit more snappy response, sir. And there isn't any for that.
No. Yeah. I got nothing. So at the request of the defense, Gene's trial was actually held without a jury, with Judge Robert H. Golmar presiding. He was found guilty by Golmar on November 14th, and a second trial that dealt with Gene's sanity, because they wanted to talk to different doctors, prosecution, defense. Golmar ruled Gene not guilty by reasons of insanity and ordered him committed to the Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. And Gene actually spent the rest of his life in mental hospitals. Judge Golmar wrote, due to prohibitive costs, Gene was only tried for one murder, that of Miss Worden. He also admitted killing Mary Hogan. So they knew he did kill two.
Yeah.
But they just, it wasn't cost effective. This guy was going to be sent to the insane asylum the rest of his life anyway. So.
Right. So what's the point of dredging up more, you know, legal fees and court costs for something for a man who's already going away for life? It makes sense, but also I feel bad for Mary Hogan's family that they never got that, like, the justice that I guess comes with a court case.
Yeah.
So, Gene died at the Mendota Mental Health Institute due to respiratory failure, secondary to, and I'm going to say it again, lung cancer, it's not liver cancer. Lung cancer on July 26, 1984, at the age of 77. Over the years, souvenir seekers have chipped pieces from his gravestone at the Plainfield Cemetery until the stone itself was stolen in 2000. It was recovered in 2001 near Seattle and was placed in storage at the County Sheriff's Department. The gravesite itself is now unmarked but not unknown, and he's interred between his parents and brother in the cemetery.
Yes. Getting possessions, I obviously collect a lot of crime stuff. Gene's possessions are really hard to get a hold of, mainly because the farm that he lived on actually was destroyed by a fire. So his possessions were actually scheduled to be auctioned off on March 30th, 1958. And the early morning of March 20th, 1958, so 10 days before that, the house was destroyed by fire. They claim it was a garbage fire. It was a crew that was burning some of the belongings they were told to. But arson was suspected, but they never officially determined that it was arson. And they really didn't care about the fire. They kind of just said, oh, well, this stuff's going away anyway. So they weren't, like I said, they weren't worried. And conveniently, the fire chief was Frank Worden, who was the son of Benice Worden's, who was Gein's last victim. So they really weren't worried. When Gein learned of the incident while he was in detention, obviously, he shrugged and said, well, just as well. So Gein didn't really care because, I mean, what he had nothing to do with it anymore. He was locked up for the rest of his life. This is where it gets a little weird. Gein's 1949 Ford sedan, which he used to haul bodies of the victims, was actually sold at a public auction for $760, which is the equivalent of $6,700 in 2019, to a carnival sideshow operator named Bunny Gibbons. Gibbons used to charge the carnival goers 25 cents admission to see it. I'd pay 25 cents to see that.
I feel like we need to do something about Bunny Gibbons. I feel like that man has some weird shit.
Yeah, I think he probably does.
So like Dalton said earlier, Ed Gein was the inspiration for a lot. He was the inspiration for the 1959 suspense novel Psycho, in addition to Alfred Hitchcock's 1960 film. He was also loosely adapted into Deranged, In the Light of the Moon. There's been a couple of like actual like documentary type films, Ed Gein, The Butcher of Plainfield, Ed Gein, The Musical in 2010.
Like it'd be hilarious.
I know. I really want to find that. And then Rob Zombie's films, House of a Thousand Corpses, and then its sequel, The Devil Rejects. Love Rob Zombie. He's phenomenal. He is the inspiration for so many. Norman Bates' Psycho, Leatherface in The Chainsaw Massacre, Buffalo Bill in The Silence of the Lamb, Dr. Oliver Thredson in American Horror Story Asylum. He has been the inspiration for so, so many. And then we quoted this in the Ed Kemper one, but yep. Here we are back correctly in the Ed Gein, Patrick Bateman in the 1991 novel American Psycho and its 2000 film adaptation, misquotes Ed Kemper to Gein saying, you know what Ed Gein said about women? He said, when I see a pretty girl walking down the street, I think two things. One part of me wants to take her out, talk to her to be real nice and sweet and treat her right. The other part wonders what her head would look like on a stick. Actually, Ed Kemper, falsely attributed to Ed Gein, but I felt it was appropriate to say it again because
absolutely
Ed Gein.
So I actually just looked up Bunny Gibson. There's not a ton on him, just on this first little thing. He actually owned a fun fair in the 1950s right around Rockford, Illinois, so not that far from me.
Oh yeah,
about an hour. And this was his most memorable attraction, obviously the car. He called it the Ed Gein Ghoul Car. And you could pay 25 cents, see it, have your picture taken next to it. Let's see here. The car was first displayed in Seymour, Wisconsin in July of 1958. In the first 2 days, it pulled more than 2,000 visitors. Wow. That's quite a bit. Officials from the
25 cents of viewing.
Yeah. Which he made a decent chunk for being back then.
I mean, he made $500 in that. Like in that first 2,000 yeah. people, which, like you said, in that
not bad, seeing as he paid what
is close to
$760,
what, like 10 grand, something crazy like that.
So the officials from the Mental Health America of Wisconsin fought to close this exhibit. They thought it was ridiculous. They didn't want it out there, and the town sheriff actually shut down the exhibit at one point. And eventually a state actually banned this exhibit from, you could not bring it to Wisconsin anymore, which I don't really agree with because I could care less. If that's what you want to do, go for it. And this is when he traveled to Southern Illinois and he just kind of faded out from there. It doesn't say whatever happened to the car. I'm kind of curious.
Yeah.
Where is the edge? Let's see.
On the spot.
Of course. Today, the whereabouts of Ed Gein's car are unknown, and there are no known photographs of the actual car.
Of course.
Bunny Gibson's disappeared as well. They don't know really where he's at, what happened to him. I'm assuming he's probably dead at this point. Because
you think?
I don't know. If he bought the car back then, I mean.
Yeah, I guess so.
He's got to be up there.
I mean, he bought it in like 85, right? 85? He could have been a young up-and-comer at that point. Or you're right, he could be dead with the car.
Yeah, there's not much on Bunny Gibson.
That's so upsetting. I was really hoping he like did so much more cool stuff than just the car.
I love it.
I was hoping he was going to be like a fantastic sideshow freak and we could have like done a really cool thing about him.
But one of them referred to it as the Mad Butcher of Plainfield's Chariot of Death.
Love that. Except it wasn't. He didn't kill that many people. He just dug people up in the cemetery. He's not a serial killer. He's a serial grave robber. An arts and crafts person.
Looking at the pictures of like let me see if I can pull it up here. It is kind of cool. Let me do a. Come on.
What, the car is cool?
Yeah. Look at that. It shows like the.
Oh, dang.
Yeah.
Okay. It's here. Ed Gein's car. $1,000 reward. If not, what?
If not here.
If not here, that's funny. The Plainfield, Wisconsin crime that shocked the nation.
Hey, look, the last one's the right.
That hauled the dead from their graves. There you go. Perfect.
There we go.
Yes. It is spot on grave robbing and murder. See, and that's really like most of what Ed Gein was. He was a grave robber.
Yeah. I mean, he's a grave robber that did
some like seriously macabre arts and crafts.
Hey.
And he killed a couple of people. When he didn't have a friend to help him dig up graves anymore.
Minor details.
I mean, yeah.
He's not as bad as some of the people.
I'm
not
saying he's as boring as Son of Sam. I'm just thank God.
Hey, he is the son of hope now.
Okay, I'm so sorry. Not saying he is as boring as the son of hope, but he's like, I feel like we need to start like a rating system. Of like,
yeah, zero like,
is Son of Hope and 10 right now is like what, Kemper, right? Put Kemper at 10 because he's badass, yeah. Right?
I mean, really, the big memorable thing of Gein is his arts and crafts. Other than that, right.
Gein's like a 2.
Yeah, I was gonna give him like maybe a 2.5 if he's lucky.
Yeah, like 2. So we'll say somewhere between 2 and 3. Like, he's fascinating, don't get me wrong. And he did some really fucked up shit. Absolutely, but like as like serial killers go, he's like a 2.
Yeah.
And even as like what he did, like again, like I could go to Michael's tomorrow and buy some sequins and sew them together and call it a nipple belt, and like, you know, it would be okay. It wouldn't be as cool as his nipple belt, but like same concept. I just didn't go dig up a body for it, you know what I mean? Like
Not committed. Come on.
I'm not as committed. And really, it's just because like I'm an old lady and my back hurts and I don't feel like digging shit up at night. I would rather go and just like get some easy stuff from the craft store.
I rather just, you know, not. I deal with enough dead people at work. I don't need any extra.
So you gotta lift them there. What the fuck?
I am not stealing bodies.
Oh, come on. If you're like rolling them down to the morgue, you can just like take those nipples off real quick, and soon enough, you'll have a great belt.
It's bad enough lifting these motherfuckers to put them in the cooler. I ain't lifting them a second time.
You have to lift them.
Yeah. Oh,
we unzip do. And just take the nipples off real quick.
Yeah, because that's not weird or anything. Yeah, hey, let's stop this car so I can grab the nipples real quick.
Yeah, hold on, guys. I need these for my arts and crafts projects. It's honestly, my homage to Ed Gein.
Some of the people at work know me. They'd just be like, yeah, it sounds like something you do.
Right, like, yeah, that's about right.
Yeah. So,
okay, who are we doing next week?
Albert Fish. Imagine that. I'm already ready to go for next week.
All right, well, he's done with his research. I need to do mine. So next week is Albert Fish, everybody.
I promise it won't
accompanied
be a shit show.
By who are we? Who is he accompanied by?
That's it.
No. There's a second one, right? We're gonna do an Herbert Mullen, right? So there's Albert Fish is gonna be our main story next week, but then you're also gonna get a bonus of Mr. Mullen because he's not that interesting by himself, but they're kind of fun together.
Yeah.
So you'll get a 2-for-1 next week, especially since it took us 2 weeks to get this episode out and this one was rough. So thank you for bearing with us.
Yeah, you know, maybe if someone would have gotten their killers straight.
Yeah, it was definitely me. All right. We will see you all next week for a fun little 2-for-1 special. And until then, have a great week, everybody. This is the Behind the Bars podcast.